And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we're going to talk about giants and lost civilizations with Pat Chouinard. So get ready. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. One of my favorite subjects, lost civilizations. Pat Chouinard has dedicated himself to the study of archaeology, lost civilizations, ancient flood myths, Atlantis, crop circles, you name it. He's produced and hosted an award-winning television series called Archaeology TV, and also became a regular contributor to Ancient American Magazine. He then started his own magazine, The New Archaeology Review. Here's Pat Chouinard on Coast to Coast. Hey, Pat, how are you?
Hi, George. Nice to be here with you and your listeners.
Looking forward to this. How did you get interested in archaeology?
Well, it goes all the way back to my interest in paleontology. When I was a young man in Ocala, Florida, we used to have an old forest out in the back of our farmhouse. So I used to go back there and dig into the dirt and find cow bones, you know, and take them to our garage and set them up and pretend they're dinosaur bones. So like when I was 5, 6, 7 years old, that was my lifelong mission, was to be a paleontologist. But it seemed that after that, I kind of evolved into becoming more interested in human past and what it means to be human. And that's when it really started to take off. And then when I got into high school, all I wanted to do was write about archaeology and history and things like that.
Well, let me tell you, this is a great field. And in the world today, where do we stand in terms of the United States and its archaeologists compared to Egyptians or other people like that, Pat?
Well, we have a very unfortunate situation, especially in this country. We have such a bankrupt educational system, and our whole culture is based on comfort and excessiveness and pleasure, and we don't have that dedication to the spirit of humanity and the spirit to learn and explore and experience. I mean, our space program is the perfect example of this. We've completely abolished something that could be the lifeblood of our species. That's our people, our Terran people, and we're getting rid of that on a mass scale. I mean, NASA is nothing now. I mean, we give it all to the Russians and Chinese, and what does that say about our dedication to science?
Yeah, it really is crazy. I mean, we don't seem to have any goals or directions for anything.
Yeah.
And that's that guy. I remember as a kid, I mean, I loved the space program. It was exciting. Today I heard a radio advertisement for NASA looking for astronauts. In my day, Pat, people would line up to be astronauts.
Yes.
Every kid in America wanted to be an astronaut.
Exactly.
Now they're out
wanted
advertising.
To be an astronaut.
Yeah.
And I also thought, I remember going back, and this goes back to my philosophy of a one world space program, too. I can remember I was sitting in my living room, and my father and I were playing with Presto Magics, which was like this little picture you would buy, and you'd have these little pictures, other pictures you would rub on, and they'd come off. Well, these were little astronauts. And on one side of the page, you had USA. And on the other side, you had USSR. And I said, and Dad said, I said to him, why don't we just join with USSR and explore space together like we should? And he goes, I don't know. It seems that we get a lot far better in the world if we work together instead of fought together. And it was that essence, that speck of a belief in a greater human unity that has driven me for so long. And that's one of the reasons I got into archaeology. It's a testament to our past, our heritage as a species.
Well, that's so true. You know, it's like a federation. I always thought, you know, why are we competing? The Europeans are doing their thing, the Russians, the Chinese.
Yes,
we
ridiculous.
Are. Why can't we get along as a planet? We can't. There's too much greed out there, Pat.
What's going to happen? You know, I hear a lot of things that are said by Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Hawking has said that we shouldn't be sending messages into space, primarily because if we look at our history, advanced civilizations don't have a very good record with primitive civilizations.
That's right. He's concerned that they're going to find us and come do something to us.
Exactly. But how are we going to defend ourselves if we're disunited like that?
Yeah. No, that is so true. And he also says it's time to leave the planet.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's essence that we have to do this, because it was Benjamin Franklin at the height of the Revolutionary War that said, we're either going to hang together or assuredly we're all going to hang separately.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of your work tonight, Patrick, a couple of your books, Lost Civilizations and Ancient Secrets and Forgotten Words as well. One of the things you key in on, you look and investigate a race of giants. Tell me about this theory.
Well, you know, it has a lot of different aspects to it, and it has to do with civilization to a large degree. And I think that, you know, we're approaching a time in our history where we're reevaluating the past and we're rewriting our history because we find new discoveries which are challenging the existing paradigm to a large degree. And I think that in this search for a new paradigm, we're coming across artifacts and mythologies and records that indicate that one time there was people of giant stature. Now, you also have to understand that in the ancient world, giants was a relative term. There were giants who were giants simply because they were of high stature.
Mm-hmm.
They were large beings with, you know, were tall. You know, they were like the Fee Fi Fo Fum guys, you know, if you know what I mean. But you also had beings of incredible technological and engineering skill, which technologically they were giants, you know. And I mean, that's kind of like what Zachariah Sitchin was saying about the Anunnaki.
Well, and it kind of echoes the book of Genesis.
Exactly, the Nephilim.
Yep.
And in the book of Enoch and the book of Giants, which is also called Ogius the Giant, is another title for that book. And the book of Giants was part of the book of Enoch that was discovered in the Qumran caves by as the Dead Sea Scrolls.
So, Pat, let's get into some of these giants. How big do you think they were?
Well, I think that they were a highly advanced race. And the interesting thing is that you have on one end the ancient astronaut, theorists, the ancient alien theorists. Now, I don't totally disagree with them. I don't discount that there was some level of interaction in ancient times between Earthers or Terrans and extraterrestrials. That obviously happened. But I think that there was an interaction on a very sophisticated level, because I think that Mesopotamia was not the first civilization. Atlantis was not the first civilization. I believe that there were hundreds, thousands of civilizations going back to a very, very remote and early time in Earth's history. An example of this chronology of an advanced race of great antiquity is consistent with the Sanskrit writings of India and the writings of my friend and colleague Michael Cramer.
That's exactly
and,
right.
That basically says that, you know, humans have been on this planet not for thousands, not for tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands and millions of years. And I think that this the giants go back to this time. And if you look at the earliest record of gods in Earth's history, in recorded history, it doesn't begin with the sky god, which, like when you're watching Ancient Aliens, which you were on,
mm-hmm.
you know, they said, well, the sky gods were the first gods, and it proved that, you know, the ancient aliens had civilized a primitive, incredulous human race, you know, out of the Stone Age. But when you read the text, the sacred text, you see that these things go back far into the distant past, and they begin with the Earth Goddess. And then once the Earth Goddess has matured to a certain degree, the sky gods and the earth gods interact. And in every mythology, this takes place. There's an interaction, a dispersal between the earth goddess and the sky god. And out of this dispersal or this union grows humanity.
Do you think the Greek gods,
the interesting thing is,
were the Greek gods, Pat, were they giants?
Yes, they were. The Titans were the first giants, and they were also born along with the Cyclops and the Hundred-Handers, which were of course distorted giants, you know, monsters of sorts, and they were born from the union of Gaia and Uranus, who was the sky god. So this is the perfect example. The giants were actually born from the union of earth and sky. And in Greek mythology, earth and sky, Uranus and Gaia, are not just gods in the anthropomorphic sense, but they are, in fact, indicative and symbolic of an earth-sky relationship and the beings which live within them.
Did human types, not the giants, but the human types who were on the planet at the time as well, why did they look at the giants as gods?
Because they had such powerful technology. And I believe that the idea of gods and giants is very possible. See, when you think about it, if there is a greater antiquity for the human race, this planet has been in existence for 6 billion years. So during that 6 billion years, there were plenty of time for advanced race or group of advanced races to evolve on this planet.
Oh, of course.
And also you have to look into also that our ancestors were not dummies. They weren't stupid people. I mean, they were highly sophisticated. And more as time goes by, we're learning that these beings and that we call our ancestors were highly advanced. We see that with the Antikythera device, which my friend David Hatchett Childress called tantamount of finding a jet airplane in the tomb of King Tut. It was a computer that was found from Hellenistic times.
Isn't that amazing?
It's just amazing, the intricacy of this clockwork perfection that they put together. And it definitely wasn't built by Dell or Apple computer.
Where do you think the giants came from, Pat?
I think they evolved on this planet at a very early time, ahead of the evolving humans.
Okay.
I think they were another branch, another race of humanity, another Terran race entirely. And I think that our legends of the Nephilim, our legends of the Greek Titans and Atlantis, I think it all plays into that.
I've seen some pictures, Pat, on the internet of skeletons of giants, people looking into a hole. Is that just hoax stuff?
You know, that's a very interesting point because, you know, we don't know what's really out there in the sense that the governments and the establishment, unfortunately, keep things from us. And that's a simple fact of life. We don't get the full truth. And we're in an age when truth is relative, and it is not what it appears to be. I mean, when you watch The X-Files back from the 90s, that was the perfect example. Our lives are a living conspiracy theory. And it's very hard to detect, you know, what is real and what isn't. It's almost like the Vikings when they went into a region for the first time. They took out their battle axes and hacked away at anything that moved just to see, hey, is this really real or is it a dwarf or a giant?
Yeah, that's a good point. These giants, where did they go? They're gone.
Well, they went extinct along with many of the other Earth creatures when the Lost Civilization ended 12,000 years ago.
Okay. All right. So they got tied into the calamity that took almost everything out.
Exactly. And it was a multiple catastrophe. It wasn't just one event. It was a number of events. I consider it an impact, probably, an astronomical problem. And then, of course, you have the situation where you have social decay and environmental decay and the falling of governments, the falling of established economies. And we see that happening today in our own civilization.
How far do you think, Pat, their technology was? I mean, were they at the point where they could have gone to the moon? You know, some have suspected that.
Well, in the Sanskrit writings of India, we have rumors and writings discussing the Vimana.
That's right, the flying machines.
Exactly. And it's possible that what we're trying to recognize as extraterrestrials, ETs, things like that, are really remnants of the giant race, survivors or even the ancient records which describe flying machines and so forth were in fact belonging to giants and not to extraterrestrials at all.
Genesis, that talks about the Nephilim, the fallen angels, the giants. What do you think they were looking at? What were they trying to interpret?
Well, an interesting thing which was forwarded by Robert Lomas and Christopher Knight in their book, Uriel's Machine. That is very interesting. It's a very interesting story, actually. They described the Nephilim as possibly the grooved wear culture of Northern Europe. And it was this Northern European enclave that eventually went to the Tarim Plateau, the Tarim Basin in Western China. And that's where we get the Caucasian mummies of China. They actually came from Northern Europe, but it was these Northern Europeans, this vanished race of Caucasians, that was the inspiration for many of these myths. Because at the time, when you think about it, people were like 5'6", 5'7", at the most. These Northern Europeans were 6 foot, 6'1", 6'2", 6'3". They were gigantic in comparison to these smaller Southern Europeans and Middle Easterns.
Well, there's an old saying where there's smoke, there's fire, and with these myths, obviously, something was going on. This was not a figment of their imaginations at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And, who knows what was happening, but, I mean, they actually, I think what they were talking about, they were trying to explain things that they witnessed, that they saw, in the best way that they could at the time.
Exactly. And I think that, but they were smart, and the first things that were written were not myths, but they were everyday experiences, everyday things that happened, and so they're writing what actually happened. They're not just writing down stories that they just concocted in their minds. There is a really ridiculous theory propagated by a woman by the name of Adrienne Mayer. She's a folklorist, and she came up with the idea that all the myths of gods and giants, demigods and dwarves, all those myths from Roman and Greek mythology were inspired only and were completely concocted by observing the bones of extinct mammoths and rhinoceroses and giant giraffes and things like that. Now, I don't really neglect the possibility that if they found those bones, that they would think they were part of that. But those myths are so complex, so involved, so highly developed and highly evolved, there would be absolutely no way that they could concoct such a brilliant account of these gods based on just seeing a few bones.
That's true. Patrick, stay with us. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And you can become a Coast Insider. Join the club for less than 25 cents a day. downloads, podcasting, special video chats, and soon to be a few other prizes. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com. You can also download a past 1,000 programs now. But you go up to coasttocoastam.com and fill out the information to join the club to become a Coast Insider. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Patrick Chouinard, our special guest, and we're talking about his work into lost civilizations and giants as well. Let's talk a little bit, Patrick, about Atlantis, where you say it was not the oldest civilization. How far back do you think this all goes?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that it could only go back millions of years. I mean, if you really read the Sanskrit writings of India, it really indicates that. And like I said before, I definitely want to subscribe to the theory of Michael Cramo, is that the past history of the human race goes back not thousands, not tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands, millions of years.
Millions of years back, yeah.
Billions of years, yes. And an example of this would be he found, you know, like full anatomical modern humans, modern skeletons in soil that's supposed to be some 620 million years.
Yeah, and metal steel balls, those little spheres that were
exactly.
So something was going on.
Something definitely was going on at a very early time.
What happened to most of the remnants of these past civilizations? I mean, just for example, look at our skyscrapers today. Mm-hmm. I saw a show on the History Channel that said that over a period of a few thousand years, if just simply left untouched, they would be down to rubble and dust.
Exactly.
It's amazing.
That's what's so stupid about the establishment. They say, well, where's your pottery shard? Where's your ruins? We don't see any of that. Well, look at the ruins that we have of civilizations that go back to 3500 BC. Look at the Sumerian civilization. What do we have left of that?
Not much.
So how could you imagine what we would have left if it goes back 10,000? 20,000, 30,000, a million, 10 million years. It would be nothing. And we're lucky to have that. We have Göbekli Tepe. And what's so amazing about that is that's a 12,000-year-old site. According to mainstream scholars, that was a time before there was organized religion, before there was a system of writing, before there was pottery, before there was organized government or society of any kind, totally incapable of producing anything substantial. Yet there it sat, waiting for discovery, and they discovered it. And it's 12,000 years old. It's at the heart of the Atlantean era. And it's a temple complex, and they're continuing to excavate, and the more they excavate, the more they find.
That is amazing. It is amazing.
You know, and some people say that Göbekli Tepe is not 12,000 years; that it's actually a 20,000 to 25,000 years.
That's in Turkey, and doesn't it also have, you know, some glimpse of intelligence on it? I mean,
oh yes. I mean, it has carved motifs of animals, and some people even believe that it was relating to the flood about the animals that were kept in the ark, because it's not too far from Mount Ararat.
How did they lift those stones to place them on top of each other?
That's another question. I was just reading a book by Christopher Dunn.
Mm-hmm.
Who was talking about how the ancients, rather than having a bunch of sleds that they were pushing along with 100 million people, well, it's 100 million people, but, you know, whatever they said it was, and all that, but they actually had machines that could lift and cut and place these immense blocks of stone in place.
And they must have been able to use some kind of resonance to move these things. Edward Leeds Scullin, you familiar with his name, Patrick? The Coral Castle?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. This little frail 120-pound guy from Latvia move these huge blocks of stone by himself.
Yeah.
He said that he, one, knew the secrets of the pyramids, and two, understood the magnetics of objects. And he said it's just not metal that gets magnetic, it's everything. And, you know, maybe he was able to develop some, you know, polarization, and he basically just floated these things into place.
See, and this is basically the heart of the ancient astronaut theory, and I don't discount it. I mean, I love the ancient aliens series, and I'd love to be on it. But what I believe was going on at an early time is an interaction and a sharing of technology, not just a one-sided where humanity was a primitive race and the aliens came down and gave them knowledge of civilization. I think this transference was equal, on an equal ground, and it was I can envision that the solar system, because I did some research in extraterrestrial archaeology as well, and I'm going to be doing a lecture on this at the AAPS conference this coming September.
Well, let's hope they're receptive to it.
Yes, and I can believe that at one time, you know, the whole solar system was abound with civilization.
Yes. And it probably still is.
Yeah, and Carl Sagan, you know, as much as we think of him as one of the world's greatest doubters, he wrote in at an early time in his life that he believed that there was bases all around the solar system from alien civilizations.
Yeah, well, that was the basis of his book Contact. That was turned into that incredible movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And what happened just yesterday, scientists said that they believe now that our galaxy possesses at least 10 billion Earth-sized planets.
Exactly. We're learning that every day.
Yep. Now, there's a couple sites in Syria that are pretty old as well, right?
Yes, yes. El Kalamar, and I can't pronounce the other one. I'm sorry.
That was, being from the Middle East, my family at least, Hamukar.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, El Hukar, that actually is a little over 5,000 years old. It's a little older than the Sumerian civilization, so it predates the Sumerian civilization by 1,000 years. However, Tel Kelmel, okay, that actually is 10,000 years old.
So it's almost
not
like
as old as Göbekli Tepe, but it's 10,000 years old, and it's possibly of the same culture. And if you look at the structures at Tel Kelmel, you'll see that there is towers. There's several towers, and this could actually have given us rise to the belief in the Tower of Babel.
That's right, exactly. You know, and who's to say that the writers of the Bible picked up real events?
Exactly.
And just interpreted the way that they heard it, or it was told, you know, from one person to the next over the eons.
And, you know, my colleague, Graham Hancock, has really taken on by storm the establishment, and has really aided in the redressing of the issue of humanity's past. And he has shown that the flood myths that are so prominent throughout the world were actually the memory and the remaining way of transmitting the knowledge of our past ancestors who perished in a great global cataclysm that was, in fact, the flood.
They did not have the luxury, at least the prior little civilizations. I'm sure the ones millions of years ago might have had high technology. But the other ones that were somewhat primitive, you know, they didn't have our luxury of being able to record things and keep them for posterity and things like that. Everything that happened, it was, you know, father to son or family member to friend saying.
Yeah, and not only that, but when the civilization was destroyed, that technology, what did exist, was destroyed. It was obliterated. It was wiped out of existence. And they didn't have the writing and the abilities to pass on to the second generation. So the best way they could was through oral stories.
Was there anything that you've investigated so far, Pat, that you have still found to be, it's had that wow effect for you?
You know, I think the most interesting thing that wows me is not really a technological feat of any type, but it's more of a racial thing. I'm finding that in the history, the biological history of North America, that there is elements in genetics that are proving that the populations of North America, in fact, probably the populations of the world 10,000, 12,000, 13,000 years ago, was highly different than the population that we know today, which could have included giants. And a perfect example of this, which I thought was just absolutely out of this world, was the discovery of Kennewick Man, a 10,000-year-old Nordic or Caucasian type person in North America before any known contact with Western civilization here in North America. And he was Caucasian. He was not Mongoloid in any
Right.
way, shape, or form. And there was another site in Florida called Windover Pond. They excavated that. They found something like 100 bodies. Their heads were completely preserved. They had brain matter still existing.
Jeez.
And when they tested it, they found a European genetic traits in those brains.
Well,
So I think that at one time, cultures and races were rather fluid. I think that there were many races that existed 8,000 years ago that simply did not leave any known descendants today. And these races no longer exist, and we don't know anything about them. But at one time, they did. And I think that one of these races that existed was a proto-Caucasoid race. I think we see that remnants of that race in the Jomon and the Innu of Japan. I see there were reports of islands outside off the shore of California, Santa Rosa Island, in which there were Indians with blonde hair and blue eyes, but they were a little different, you might say, than the blonde, blue-eyed people that you would find in Northern Europe. They were simply a different race, and they were tall and large and definitely giant-like. The Paiutes of Nevada and Utah in North America talk about a giant race of red-haired giants who gave them much trouble and who had inhabited this land 15,000 years before the arrival of the Mongoloid
Isn't
species.
that amazing? Something happened. They saw something.
Exactly.
I mean, they don't make these stories up. Do you believe in an extraterrestrial presence on this planet?
I do.
Me too. Me too. I don't know where they are, where they went, but if you look at the Sumerian tablets of Sitchin,
Yeah,
something
exactly.
happened there.
Exactly. And they were giants too. So I think that there was a time when this planet was not a outpost or an island of life. I think it was a crossroads of civilizations. Just as North America itself, it was a crossroads of civilization between East and West. I think that the Earth was a crossroads of civilizations from across the galaxies.
Do you think that's reflective in all the many races we have on this planet today?
And I think that diversity is a key to our evolution as a species. I don't think it's something to be scared of, nothing to be frightened of. It's nothing to disdain. It is a strength. It is a power. It's the inner faith of our own species. And I think if we grasp upon that, if we grasp upon a greater humanity in which the people of all races are a part of, I think that we're reaching a new level of consciousness.
Well, I look at the races on this planet based on their geography, and I'm trying to determine, Patrick, okay, do they look the way they look because of environment,
They do.
or were they dumped there from another civilization from above? Who knows? But a lot of them on this planet, look like the environment that they're in. You know,
well, I'll explain that. I don't think they're from extraterrestrials, but for instance, people who live in southern areas where there's a lot of sun, a lot of heat,
are generally darker.
Right, because they have more melanin in their skin.
Exactly. People from the northern countries are generally lighter.
That. Yeah. They're lighter. Like even like look at some of the northern Chinese and compare the northern Chinese with the South Vietnamese.
Well, why though? Why for those who are Asian, you know, the eye shape is different than
right.
someone from Europe. What
right.
would environment do to do that?
Well, a lot of it too has to do with traits, because the genetics, you know, certain traits were prevalent in certain populations. Some populations might not have had that trait. It just so happens out of random selection and random existence that there happened to be a few people with that feature. And the emphatic fault actually is an adaptation against the cold.
Interesting. It is. Well, what a resilient planet that allows its species to adapt to whatever environment or condition it might be in.
Let me tell you something. If we ever go back into space, humanity will be diversified in a way we cannot possibly imagine.
Oh, we won't have any muscle mass, that's for sure, will we?
No, but listen, if we go to other worlds, we're going to adapt to those worlds. We're going to have Martian humans, and we're going to have humans that grew up in the sulfur mountains of Io on Jupiter.
Well, so let me ask you this then. Let's say humans go to Mars in 100 years,
yeah,
and they colonize, and they're
correct.
There for 1,000 years,
yeah.
And then those Martians who were humans,
they have their own traits.
Okay, and if they came here, would they look different from the humans that were on this planet?
They would. They would have a different size. They would have different, I would imagine, different color hair, different color eyes, because they would be adapting. I would imagine that really knowing humans, probably the ones that would adapt most effectively to a terraformed Martian environment, would be Northern Europeans or Northern Asians, because Mars is further away from the sun. So even if it's terraformed, even if it's warmer, even if it's livable, its environment is going to be like that of Northern Europe or Northern Asia.
That's true.
So maybe even we could even consider this. Maybe there will be populations of Northern Asians and Northern Europeans on Mars inhabiting that area. Maybe they would migrate there because it's similar to their own environment back on Earth. Then they intermix, interbreed. Then you have a hybrid race of Northern Asian and Northern European.
It is fascinating and very probable, isn't it?
And see, people have a real wrenching, gut-wrenching instinct against race mixing. The trouble is that humans, if you are able to produce viable offspring, and you're close together, you're going to interbreed. It's just human nature. You're always going to interbreed.
Sure.
And in the ancient world, people didn't see a harm in that. It wasn't.
If you look at things in the Bible, it was obviously quite prevalent, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Look at the Romans. Romans had no such racial prejudice whatsoever.
Patrick, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back and talk more with you about giants and lost civilizations and some phone calls as well on Coast to Coast AM.